For the remainder of this hour, the credibility of American intelligence, as he mentioned, clearly a huge issue on this side of the Atlantic. We're going to look at how U.S. intelligence is gathered, how it's supposed to be understood, and whether the Iraq information process differed from previous practice. How smart was U.S. intelligence, and how smartly was it used? If you have questions about those issues, our phone number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us here in Studio 3A is Sam Gardner, retired Air Force colonel who teaches military operations and planning. And welcome back to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
How is this supposed to work? Now, most people think that intelligence is gathered by the Central Intelligence Agency. Most of it is not.
Well, that's true, Neil. And the one thing you can probably say is making any simple statement about how we do intelligence is wrong. You can sort of break it down. There is a Defense Intelligence Agency whose job it is primarily to focus on things that the military would be interested in. How many of what kinds of forces? What can they do?
And how fast can this jet fly?
Sure, sure. The Central Intelligence Agency tends to be a little more political in its thing. Will the leadership do this? Will the leadership do that? They also are the primarily operators of the spies, although Defense Intelligence has their own. Then there is the National Security Agency. They're the guys that collect on the radio waves, on the Internet, for outside the United States, and they feed both of these agencies. There is a mapping agency who collects for all of them satellite photographs, interprets some of them. There is in the State Department a group of people who analyze all of this stuff and put a particular state perspective on it. And then maybe the new thing in this Gulf, too, that needs to be talked about is there seems to have been a special office created in the Pentagon whose job it was to probably do a couple things, to analyze the intelligence all these other people were doing in a special way, in a new way, and also they may have been doing some collecting of their own, specifically on Iraq, specifically on WMD and terrorism.
Now, going back over this, Sam, I mean, most of these collectors of intelligence already work for the Secretary of Defense, don't they?
Well, the CIA does not. The CIA is,
But those are the analysts primarily, other than the spies.
That's true. I think what you would have to say, Neil, is what we got the sense of. The Secretary of Defense wasn't happy with the answers he was getting. And honestly, he felt that there was more there than was being told him. And he wanted some people who could put a particular magnifying glass on the issues he was interested in.
And as this process continues, I mean, is all of this intelligence data, this raw intelligence, as it's called, is that funneled to these analysts in Langley at the CIA headquarters, and they sift through it and say, well, that looks important. If you put it with this piece of information, it suggests that maybe this.
Well, what we have been reading, Neil, is that during this process, there was probably some that wasn't. There's enough evidence out there to suggest that what was happening is some of this special intelligence that was being collected by the Pentagon and looked at with their eyes was going directly to the National Security Council and the President. The Secretary of Defense was trying to make an argument. His argument was that they had WMD, that they were connected to terrorists, and that we needed to take the regime down.
Now, when you say the CIA is primarily concerned with political parts of this, I mean, you mean small P political in the sense.
Yes, no, you're right. Not American political, but political as in the what's going on in the nation, as in the relationship of the Ba'ath Party in Iraq to Saddam Hussein, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, at a broad level like that. Mm-hmm. Although they do military stuff too.
And the NIE that we heard a little bit about, we just have a few seconds left in this segment of the program, Sam, but the National Intelligence Estimate, some of it was declassified at the end of last week. That is put together by all of these different agencies. Everybody has to sign off.
Right. Everybody has to participate.
Ah.
The interesting thing is they don't necessarily agree. And for a long time, the tradition has been a footnote. Now, that's not a trivial thing. When an agency puts a footnote in, as the State Department did on this projection of nuclear capability for Iraq, that's a very important bureaucratic note. And in ways, I know when I used to read them, you would go through and look at the footnotes first, because that told you what might be issues. So the footnote is not a footnote in a national intelligence estimate.
When we come back from the break, we'll continue our discussion on intelligence. Bruce Berkowitz of the Hoover Institution will join the discussion, and we'll talk about whether or not intelligence producers and intelligence consumers have opposing concerns. Our phone number, 800-989-8255. The email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about intelligence, how it's gathered, how it's analyzed, and whether the credibility of American intelligence is in question now after the failure to discover weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. If you'd like to join our discussion, our phone number is 800-989-8255, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is retired Air Force Colonel Sam Gardner, and joining us now is Bruce Berkowitz, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, the author of The New Face of War, How War Will Be Fought in the 21st Century, and good to have you back on the program as well.
Great to be here.
Now, you've been listening to what we've been talking about so far. How did the intelligence gathering and dissemination and analysis process differ in this case than it has in the past, from your point of view?
I really don't think that anybody can make a conclusion at this time, but it seems to me that much of the controversy that we're seeing today is because many people are confusing three different things. One is what goes into intelligence, the second is what goes into a presidential speech, and the third is why we decided to go into Iraq. They're very different, and when you mix and match the three, you wind up with the controversy exactly like what we have today.
Elaborate. Tell me more.
Well, intelligence estimates are supposed to be based on a combination of hard fact and less certain facts that we obtain through our intelligence agencies. But the president can use any number of materials in his speech. Some of it will be intelligence, some of which he can talk about if it's been declassified. But a lot of it is public information, information provided by foreign governments, or for that matter, just plain logic. So if one fact or another is shown after events not to have been true, it could have been a piece of intelligence that was faulty, or it could have been a piece of public information was faulty, or it could have just been one of those areas in which a political official was having to use his best judgment and was proved perhaps to be right or not yet proved to be right.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, much of the controversy is about why haven't we found weapons of mass destruction? And the one thing we know for sure is that weapons of mass destruction are hard to locate.
Indeed, the British expert who committed suicide last week communicated to Judy Miller of the New York Times in an email just before he killed himself that he was now worried that forensic recovery is not going to be possible in Iraq because it was going to be so difficult. But Sam, before the break, was talking about the disagreements among the different intelligence agencies. This is not unusual, as he suggested when he was reading these national intelligence estimates. He always looked for the dissent before he, as well as the consensus. But in this case, I mean, these are very serious questions.
But that's exactly how the process is supposed to work when you put together a national intelligence estimate. The process is designed to highlight those areas in which there is uncertainty. And when there's uncertainty, political officials have to make their best judgments.
Mm-hmm. Our phone number again, 800-989-8255. And let's begin with Terry, who joins us on the phone from St. Louis.
Hey, how you doing?
Okay.
That's good. Actually, my question was, I mean, if these are our professionals that we hire to do this job, where do we get off second-guessing their abilities? I mean, if this is what they said they gathered, where do everyone else get off by second-guessing it, I guess is my biggest question.
Okay. Sam was talking about the disagreements among the different intelligence agencies. This is not unusual, as he suggested when he was reading these national intelligence estimates. He always looked for the dissent before he, as well as the consensus. But in this case, I mean, these are very serious questions.
But that's exactly how the process is supposed to work when you put together a national intelligence estimate. The process is designed to highlight those areas in which there is uncertainty. And when there's uncertainty, political officials have to make their best judgments.
Mm-hmm. Our phone number again, 800-989-8255. And let's begin with Terry, who joins us on the phone from St. Louis.
Hey, how you doing?
Okay.
That's good. Actually, my question was, I mean, if these are our professionals that we hire to do this job, where do we get off second-guessing their abilities? I mean, if this is what they said they gathered, where do everyone else get off by second-guessing it, I guess is my biggest question.
Okay. Sam, do you want to take that?
I'll try that, Terry. I guess I would say we've got to find the beef. Where's the beef? And it's not just the WMD thing. And I want to point out that we're not, if you go back to what was said before the war, we're not looking for trace elements. Secretary Powell said at the UN between 100 and 500 metric tons of chemicals. He said they have those.
Mm-hmm.
He said they have drones that, and the president said, could reach the United States. He said they had 24 Scud missiles. None of this stuff, and I could go on. I think the list now that I've been doing some research for the last 6 weeks, it's about 30 items long, which we said and have not proven or shown up. So it's not just...
To be fair, Secretary Powell also said the mobile biological weapons labs, which they may have found.
18, he said, Neil. We found two.
But you know, we haven't found Saddam Hussein either, and nobody denies that he exists.
That he exists, yeah, exactly. But not just that. I mean, look how much time they had to get rid of it. I mean, the UN delayed attack. Although delayed, do you think Saddam was just sitting on it and said, I know he's coming, so I'm just going to sit on this till they get here?
But that, Terry, raises the question, and that goes to the heart of this British controversy, that their allegation in the so-called dodgy dossier, that there was chemical weapons ready to be used within 45 minutes of an order from Saddam Hussein. If you're going to have these things and you're going to risk the approbation of the world, possible invasion, are you going to have them ready to be used as military weapons, stockpiled, ready to go, or hidden away? What good do they do the Iraqi army, hidden away in a cave somewhere?
Secretary Powell said again at the UN that there was a missile battery in the Baghdad vicinity that was loaded with biological weapons that moved every 1 to 4 weeks. And the implication was, he didn't say 45 minutes, but the implication was that unit was ready to fire on American troops.
But we've also found the mask over there. I mean, do you think they were just using that for show, or were they using it actually preparing? I mean, I guess my...
I'm sorry, what was that word?
I mean, they finding these gas masks and stuff that was being used, obviously, by their armies.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I guess, I mean, are they using that just for dress, or were they actually using it because they knew that they had... I guess my biggest position is, I'm glad Bush went over there, I'm glad Saddam's out of power, and I'm just not one that's going to sit around here and bite my president's head off for doing the right thing.
Okay. Terry, thanks for the call, but go ahead, Sam.
I would like to address the gas mask, because that's when I first began to have concerns. I've read very carefully everything that's been written about what we've found. We have found 3,000 chemical suits. The British have found 100. Now, that's not an army that's equipped to fight in a chemical environment.
Mm-hmm. These questions go back. I wanted to, Bruce Berkowitz, you to address the other issue that Sam brought up in this office within the Pentagon that was apparently separate. Was that new? Was that different?
It may have been a new office, but it wasn't a new anything that was unusual. all political officials, Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, and so on, like to have their own staff of intelligence advisors, precisely because they need to know where the hard facts end, where they need to fill in their own judgments, and also they need people that can speculate about where the intelligence community as a whole ought to be looking, but might not have thought of yet. But one thing that I'd like to get back to is, why haven't we found the WMD yet? And it's worth remembering a little bit of history here. Iraq had a nuclear weapons program in 1982, and we had very little evidence of it. They had a nuclear weapons program in 1992, and we actually didn't find hard evidence of it until several years later, even after we had inspectors on the ground looking for it. Many people don't realize it, but South Africa actually had an operational nuclear arsenal during the 1970s, 1980s. They had a half dozen nuclear weapons. And there was very little evidence of it. Even nuclear weapons programs can be hidden so that they're very hard even for our intelligence organizations to find.
India and Pakistan are other cases.
It's only been a few months. But yes, you're right. One thing that we're learning about weapons of mass destruction is that rogue states can develop them and be very, very good at hiding them.
Email question from John Haig in Columbus, Ohio. I'd like to hear your guest comment on the fact that National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, according to her own admission, did not read the entire 90 pages of the National Security Estimate. Is that plausible? And how often is an NIE created? I guess plausibility we're going to have to leave up to Condoleezza Rice. But how is an NIE created?
Usually an NIE is triggered either because a major policy initiative is being considered and the principals want to have the best thinking of the intelligence community, or there are some issues like estimates of the military forces of certain foreign powers that we do on a routine basis.
And are they routine every 6 months, every year, every 2 years?
Some of them are routine. Some of them are done each year. But all the players who work on them together have a familiarity with each other. These are not strangers who get into a room all of a sudden and try to make sense of the issue.
Let's go now to Carl, who's on the line with us from Fort Lauderdale.
Yes, hi. My question is on the way the intelligence that is gathered by the NSA and the other agencies are explained to the public. How much of it is actually not being told to us? And how much of it is left out to give their own political message as to what they want the public to believe?
So how much, I'm just trying to clarify your question, Carl, how much of this is presented by the intelligence agencies themselves, and how much is it presented by their bosses, essentially?
Well, I know the intelligence agencies don't give public briefings unless it's a very extenuating circumstances. That's usually left to the executive branch. Now, when the information is given to the executive branch, how much of it is actually left out, and how do they decide that?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question, and later in the program, David Gergen, who's worked in a few White Houses, will be joining us to talk about exactly that. But, Sam, from your perspective?
Sure, Neil. Actually, in this case, we had quite a bit of public information available. There, first of all, was in October, the Central Intelligence Agency released an unclassified summary of their intelligence on Iraq. Fairly interesting and specific about what they thought they had. Between October and the time we went to the war, there were two, maybe three white papers produced by the White House which summarized the intelligence information we knew. Then there were the famous two British dossiers, which included some mixture of intelligence and open source materials that there's been so much controversy over. And I think that's one of the fascinating things about this, because the material does exist, so you can go back and trace the evolution of the argument for a system one of the components of the reason for going to war for about a year and a half through these public statements.
Mm-hmm. Bruce Berkowitz, is it just seems to be human, if not political, nature to look at the information that you you want to believe and dismiss the information you don't.
There are really too many checks and balances on it for that to happen, because within the intelligence community, most of this activity happens out of public eye. But there are many independent organizations that are debating, competing with each other, presenting different lines of evidence. It's not one homogeneous body of people who are generating these products. And so because there are so many different agencies with access to much of the same information, it's really hard to put a political spin on a coordinated intelligence document, at least not for any length of time.
Because eventually, if you're wrong, somebody's going to come back and say, wait a minute, I told you differently.
And not only do many agencies in the executive branch have access to that information, but the intelligence oversight committees on the Hill have access maybe not to all the details, but certainly to the main findings. You have to understand that intelligence is produced as a flow of information. There's a history to it, and there's a pace and a current to it. So it's really hard for any one player in this process to bring in a single scrap of paper and bring the entire proceedings to a halt. It just doesn't happen that way.
Carl,
only in movies.
Carl, thanks very much for the question.
Thank you.
We're speaking with Bruce Berkowitz of the Hoover Institution and with retired Air Force Colonel Sam Gardner about the questions of U.S. intelligence in the aftermath of the war against Iraq. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go to Peter now, who's on the line from San Francisco.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The day before Congress gave President Bush the power to use the military, in Iraq, George Tenet had written a letter, and it got published in the New York Times. In this letter, he was saying how he didn't think it was a good idea to attack Iraq. He think he would actually make America more unsafe, that they're about 10 years away from having these weapons. Is this letter having any bearing on his credibility as head of the CIA?
I think you may have paraphrased Mr. Tenet's letter, but go ahead, Sam.
That doesn't seem to be among the issues right now. I remember the case that Peter's talking about, but the things that people are talking about are focusing on the...
Just to clarify, wasn't this the analysis that Saddam Hussein might be more dangerous, was not cooperating with al-Qaeda and might be more dangerous after a war than before?
And there was a very interesting part of that national intelligence estimate that was released last week, which said that as the regime starts to fall, he may take, if he has weapons of mass destruction, and be inclined to give them to terrorists, even if he hadn't done it now. So I think that was the argument from which he was working.
Mm-hmm. And what about his, and certainly Director Tenet has become a central figure in this most recent controversy over the inclusion of those famous 16 words in the State of the Union address, Bruce?
I think that those 16 words have probably gotten a bit more play than they should. If you recall, most of the debate at the time that the Congress authorized the administration to use military force in Iraq, most of the debate was about whether or not the United States was going to go to the United Nations. Well, we went to the United Nations, and most of Powell's presentation was not aimed at proving conclusively that the Iraqis had weapons of mass destruction. His presentation was actually aimed at showing that the Iraqis were not complying with UN resolutions requiring them to admit the inspectors and to disarm. And what he showed in his presentation, using sometimes intelligence information, were several cases in which the Iraqis were not cooperating or were hiding information and so on. And that's what most of the debate was at the time, as I recall.
Okay. Peter, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And let's get a question from Steve, who's in Denver, Colorado.
Hello.
Hi, Steve.
How are you doing today? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is that, my understanding is that the new Bush doctrine of a preemptive strike is solely based on the assumption that we can identify clearly an imminent threat through our intelligence gathering. And previously, that had been an interpretation of preemption had been based on visible gathering of armies, navies, and air forces. And so if our intelligence has been exaggerated or misused, or even if the intelligence is just completely incorrect, how can the new doctrine of preemption still be considered an option when it's based on malleable information?
Obviously, weapons of mass destruction can a lot less visible often than armies and navies and air forces. Bruce Berkowitz?
Really?
Yeah, I think I'd put it a little bit differently. I think that the result of September 11th was a realization that because terrorist organizations can deploy covertly and armies that operate like terrorist organizations can deploy covertly on a global basis, and because they had potential access to weapons of mass destruction, that we no longer had the luxury of waiting to just simply retaliate. And so what it did is it's put more pressure on the intelligence community to come up with the information that we need to make these assessments. But in the end, the decision to strike or not strike is always going to be a political judgment.
Sam, we just have in 30 seconds. Can you address this issue of, if the credibility of the U.S. intelligence comes into question after Iraq, who's going to believe it the next time they say there's an imminent threat?
Well, I must say that when one reads what's coming out about North Korea right now, you sort of scratch your head and you say, is this the same, or is this, because they've supposedly discovered a second site this mm-hmm. week, and I don't know the answer to the question.
Steve, thanks very much for the call. And by the way, we're going to bring you an update on what we know about the nuclear situation in both Iran and North Korea, the other two members of the Axis of Evil, tomorrow at this time on Talk of the Nation. So stay tuned for that. We're talking about how intelligence is gathered and analyzed. When we come back from a break, we're going to be joined by David Gergen, who's going to talk about how intelligence is used by decision makers in the White House. And we'll check in on the newest 44-year-old in the major leagues. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing how intelligence is gathered and then used to make policy decisions, like the decision to begin the war in Iraq. If you'd like to join our conversation, 800-989-8255 is the phone number. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now from Aspen, Colorado, to talk about what it's like from the inside of the White House is David Gergen, presidential advisor in four administrations, President Reagan's director of communications, currently director for the Center of Public Leadership at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. And David Gergen, always good to have you on the program.
Thank you, Neil. It's good to talk to you again.
You were not a security advisor, but help us understand how the White House uses intelligence once it's presented by the CIA.
Well, Neil, in the last year and a half, when I was in the Clinton administration, I was engaged on the national security side as part of my portfolio there, and it was eye-opening in many ways. A ton of information flows into the White House from the intelligence agencies today, but it's usually then summarized by the agencies, and a morning report is given to the president every day. It's usually 20 or 30 pages, very classified, of what's been happening in the last 24 hours and trend lines. And he begins his day ordinarily with a briefing from the CIA, and that's a very closely held document, the president's daily intelligence briefing. That document is seen usually only by the National Security Advisor, the president, the chief of staff, and perhaps one or two others as assigned or who have a need to know. But that becomes the basis for what the president is told each morning. And then his day starts with that, and then he has the CIA folks leave, but they're there to answer questions, and then they leave. And that information is then not the summary is so closely held. Other people in the White House staff ordinarily don't see it; they're not cleared to see it.
How long is that?
It's usually 20 or 30 pages that daily intelligence brief. But much of the decision making within the national security team is made based on those briefs. There is a decision making body that the NSC director, and that's why the NSC advisor is so important. There is a gathering almost at least once a week, but sometimes two or three times a week in special, you know, when there's a lot of outside pressure or stress in an international situation, and a meeting in a situation room where the NSC advisor calls together the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, the CIA director, head of the Joint Chiefs, and two or three others as assigned. That's, again, a very small group. Now, most of that group will have been informed each day by the President's daily intelligence brief, and they will also have had a lot of other information. But that is the group that then makes recommendations to the President, who he sits down with on a regular basis to think through what his policy decisions are going to be. It's not the group that prepares a presidential speech, such as the State of the Union, but they're the core advisors who make decisions based upon intelligence as well as policy and other issues.
Now, so when you were communications director, for example, would you hear the same thing that the rest of us in the public would hear? We can't tell you that piece of information, national security?
Absolutely. If you're not cleared within the White House staff, and ordinarily, for example, the head of the communications department would not he or she would have security clearances, but not all the way up to the top security clearances. In other words, you would have sufficient that you could see some of the lower level material, but you could not see the most sensitive. Only when you're sort of you have to be designated. I ultimately got a very high security clearance, but it was so you see the more private or more confidential material. But the rest of it is not shared within the White House staff. So, for example, people writing speeches over in the old executive office building or the Eisenhower building now, it would not have access to that kind of material. But, Neil, there's one other aspect of this that is very it's happened within the last 15 to 20 years, and that is the coming of very sophisticated technology has made it possible for in 20 years ago, 30 years ago, the intelligence would come flowing into the CIA. All the reports from DIA would come into the CIA, come into the State Department, come into the Defense Department, and they would have their own individual take. They would then distill, summarize, and bring to the President's attention various pieces, but the information would not be flowing into the White House itself. Our modern technology permits the Situation Room in the basement of the West Wing to be a hub, not only for the summarized reports, but all the raw data, all the raw intelligence, all the reports coming in to the State Department, Defense Department, simultaneously come into the White House, so that the people who do have high security clearances, that includes the Vice President, can go read that raw data anytime they want. For example, Al Gore used to love to read, as Vice President, a lot of the raw reports before they were distilled and summarized by the CIA. And Dick Cheney obviously has access and does read some of that. And that puts the White House in a position where it's actually looking over the shoulder of the CIA. In other words, they don't wait for them to summarize. They're looking at they're looking at the same raw reports the CIA is, and they can come to independent conclusions, and they can then have a much more spirited pushback kind of argument if they're looking for things. This Niger report, for example, got to the Vice President. I don't know in what form it got to him, but he started asking questions about it.
This the report that Iraq was trying to buy uranium in Niger, which turned out to be incorrect.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's so the White House now can reach in a lot more than it ever did before, and it can direct diplomats. It can do things right up to the minute it knows what's happening. When there's an action going down somewhere overseas, that used to come into the Defense Department. The Defense Department would call the White House. That's no longer the case. The White House knows about it at the same time the Defense Department does, and that can mean a lot of micromanaging from the White House on military policy or on intelligence, the management of intelligence and the conclusions one wishes to draw from the intelligence raw data. And that raw data can include a lot of very intercepts that you don't know that are very ambiguous, fragmentary information, stuff that is just it's like panhandling for gold. You've got to let things sort of sift through your pan before you can figure out what the nuggets are. And we pay a lot of money to people over the agency to do that, but now you can get people at the White House, you know, looking in and doing much the same kind of work and coming to, by the way, to somewhat different conclusions about what it all means. They may see a pattern at the White House of a perfidious and dangerous Saddam that the State Department, which is seeing some of the same stuff, may not see. The State Department sees a different pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And that accounts for a lot of the backing and forthing that we're now hearing about how to interpret the data on what kind of threat Saddam or indeed North Korea pose.
Let's get a question. Maxine joins us on the phone from Boulder, Colorado.
Hi. I'm just curious as to how it could possibly be anybody's responsibility other than the president for the decisions that were made and the statements that were made in the State of Union, particularly what you've just been discussing. If that information is accessible, how is it possible that the finger can be pointed at anyone else?
Well, it's a good question, Maxine. And Harry Truman, of course, had on his desk the sign, "The buck stops here," and that ultimately is where it stops. In truth, as we know, in all complex organizations, a lot of information is summarized long before it gets to or is pared down and put into one-page or two-page forms long before it gets to the person at the top. And I think all the evidence here, it's very clear the White House and the administration should be held accountable on the uranium statement. It's very clear that the president ultimately bears responsibility. But I think it's also pretty clear there's no evidence that the president knew anything other than what he said, that he did it innocently. But there were people below who clearly manipulated the information.
Maxine, you're asking about the statement. I think that somebody said, the president of the United States is not a fact checker.
Yeah, well, I mean, this just, to me, it's, I'm old enough to remember Watergate, and I keep having these flashbacks to the threads being pulled back and pulled back, and the finger, okay, it's Tenet, okay, it's this bit of information, okay, it's the analysts. Well, ultimately, to me, the responsibility is the president's, and he has to take it.
I think that ultimately the president does have to take responsibility. Whether he actually knew or not is a different question, and I don't think there's any evidence that he knew that the uranium statement that he made in the statement as to the Union was as dubious as it was.
But
he does take. I think he does have to take responsibility.
Well, I think he also has to take responsibility for creating a climate.
I agree.
Where that information was the information that was pushed through.
I think what we see, Maxine and Neil, is that there were those in the administration who were pushing the intelligence agencies very hard to find evidence linking Saddam to Al Qaeda. Find evidence making Saddam to be a very imminent threat to the United States, and that they were looking for patterns, and they were pushing the agencies to do that, and there were some pushback, at least by the State Department, and indeed by George Tenet ultimately. But, the White House, if you're a CIA director in the White House, and the White House has got one mission beyond yours, that is, they not only must assess the intelligence, but they must make decisions that are ultimately political in nature, that have a political component. And if they tell you, look, we want to say this is the British, and that's what they say, well, that's technically accurate. It was the British. But then the CIA at that point in the negotiations said, well, if that's what you guys really want to say, you know what we think, but we're not going to object. It's up to you. Hmm. And so it is a White House I think in this case it's very clear that the White House ultimately made the decision about the uranium statement. It's very clear ultimately the White House is making the big decisions about where to put our military forces.
Maxine, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you so much.
We're speaking with David Gergen about the quality, the uses, and the credibility of American intelligence, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Now let's bring Sam Gardner and Bruce Berkowitz back into the conversation to join us. And it's, David, I wanted to begin by asking you, the question is about overall, it's a question about political or allegations of political manipulation of intelligence to further a preconceived agenda, a preconceived
right.
decision.
Right.
Have you been in any administration where that allegation was not made?
No. And let me give you an example. In the Clinton administration, I think, when we were trying to get the NAFTA treaty with Mexico and Canada approved by the Congress. We were selective in what facts we emphasized and in order to win and in order to persuade. And there is in every administration, and you could and the opponents could come and say in the retrospect, well, you guys hype this. I think that does occur in administrations. I do think that when it's a question of whether you commit soldiers to war, that there is a special burden placed on the government, the White House, to be absolutely candid with the American people, and to present the case in a way that is as straightforward. And in this situation, I think they ought to be as straightforward as they can about accounting for what happened. But to say that this hasn't happened a lot in history is wrong. I mean, FDR, for example, it's very famously, I think, engaged in forms of deception before the Second World War that helped to increase the climate of acceptance of war and preparation for war. And there was obviously a huge amount of deception, and I think one of the worst scandals of modern times was in the Vietnam War, when we were as misled as we were about what was happening there.
We just have a couple of minutes left, but gentlemen, I wanted to get your take on this as well. Bruce Berkowitz?
There's always a tension between policymakers and intelligence analysts. Policymakers, if they have any sense of responsibility, always push intelligence analysts to test their assumptions or to consider new ideas. That's a healthy process. That's how people in the world in general today use information. And I don't think that we would want to have just a intelligence community that existed in isolation and wasn't forced to have that kind of interaction with the people who have to use their product.
And Sam Gardner?
My concern, Neil, and I guess David, is the fact that the White House had two things going on at once. One of them was a major marketing campaign orchestrated by the Office of Global Communications, and this included people in and outside the administrations whose job it was clearly to sell the war. And I can't distinguish between intelligence and what was going on there. That's why, to me, it's such a concern.
I would argue that it is very healthy to push the intelligence agencies and test their assumptions always. At the end of the day, though, this particular controversy, which has taken on legs and life of its own, I do think has serious repercussions for us as we face the prospect of a president who wants to come to us and say it's either North Korea or Iran or maybe both that are now threatening, and we need to take action or do something more based on our intelligence. And given this kind of background, I think they have paid a price for this, for pushing as hard as they did and engaging in what appears to have been hype. And in that sense, I think it's not been healthy for American policy.
Well, again, we're going to bring you an update on what we know or think we know about what's going on in North Korea and Iran tomorrow at this time on Talk of the Nation. But I'm afraid we're out of time for today. David Gergen, thanks very much.
Thank you.
David Gergen of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Sam Gardner, always good to have you.
Retired colonel
in the U.S. Air Force. And Bruce Berkowitz of the Hoover Institution, thanks for coming in.
Good to be back.
Tomorrow will be an update on the nuclear proliferation issues regarding North Korea and Iran, the other two members of the Axis of Evil. So join us tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Stay tuned to NPR News for an update on the situation in Liberia later today on All Things Considered. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.